Gospel lesson is from Luke chapter 15 or 17, verses 5 through 10. The apostles said to the Lord, "Increase our faith." And the Lord replied, "If you had faith the size of a mustard seed, you could say to this mulberry tree, 'Be uprooted and planted in the sea,' and it would obey you. Who among you would say to your slave who has just come in from plowing or tending sheep in the field, 'Come here at once and take your place at the table'? Would you not rather say to him, 'Prepare supper for me, and put on your apron, and serve me while I eat and drink. Later, you may eat and drink.' Do you thank a slave for doing what was commanded? So you also, when you have done all that you were ordered to do, say, 'We are worthless slaves. We have done only what we ought to have done.'" The word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. Let us pray. God, as we ponder these words from Habakkuk and Luke today, pray that by your Spirit you may help us to better understand what it means to be people of faith. That may the words of my mouth and meditations of my heart be acceptable in your sight, O God, our rock and our Redeemer. What is faith? And what does it look like? How do we experience it? How do we see it in others? How much faith does one need? I'm going to start out with a text from Habakkuk today. Would be easy to take that last verse which was read, "Look at the proud, their spirit is not right in them, but the righteous live by their faith," and think that that shows us not to be proud, but to do the best we can to be righteous and live by faith. We might come to the conclusion that righteousness and justice is the way we want to live and thereby show how faithful we are, how much faith we have. But taking this verse out of the greater context and lifting it onto the preaching pedestal would be a mistake. Habakkuk invites us to dwell on what righteous faith actually looks like. A person speaking in anger at God. Habakkuk is one of a kind of a book. I can't say that Habakkuk is one of those Old Testament books that I have read very often, but I found this interesting, so I wanted to share some of this with you today. Rachel Wren writes, "Habakkuk contains no direct address to the listener. Every other biblical prophetic book speaks at some point directly to the human audience. Not so for Habakkuk. The entire book records a conversation between the prophet and God. As we, the listeners, simply lurk in comments, and the comments section of this book is fire. To borrow some modern terminology, the prophet is angry at God, and he is not afraid to let God know it. The meat and heart and heat of Habakkuk's anger at God start in Habakkuk chapter 1, verses 2 to 4. Habakkuk begins the oracle against God with the phrase that signals a particular type of speaking. How long? This phrase signals to listeners that Habakkuk is using a lament genre, much like Once Upon a Time. You know what's coming after that, a fairy tale with a moral and a happy ending, hopefully. So how long is a sign of a lament that is coming? Listeners in Habakkuk's time could expect within a lament some kind of testimony to the pain that the speaker is experiencing, along with a request for God to do something about that pain. Habakkuk is not just asking a question of God. Habakkuk is saying, I not only want to know how long, I want to signal to you, God, that I am wholly and heartily sick and tired of what is happening around here, and I think it's beyond time that you begin to do something about it." Have you ever felt that way? Have you ever wanted to give God a strong piece of your mind if you could afford it, but you held back because you didn't think people of faith ought to be yelling at God. Laments are sometimes desperate. Laments are sometimes sorrowful. Laments such as Habakkuk's are angry. Habakkuk blames God for the violence running rampant. Verse 2 reads, "Oh Lord, how long shall I cry for help and you will not listen, or cry to you violence and you will not save?" The prophet cries, God ignores. Violence rages and no divine being engages. Verse 3 describes the dire nature of the situation. Desolation and carnage are before me. Strife and struggles are surging. Habakkuk is choking on the violence all around him, dumbfounded by the fact that God seems inexplicably silent and absent. The prophet is so sick and tired of the bloodshed that in verse 4 he makes one of the most radical statements in the Bible. Most English translations soften it, translating the Hebrew into something like, "So the law becomes slack and justice never prevails." That word translated "becomes slack" is a Hebrew word that can also be translated "fails." Law is associated with Torah, the books of Moses, and the law that God laid out to them so that the people could have a relationship with him by keeping the law. So in that way, it is, it's like the word in John 1. So if we read this, "Your word, God, has failed." Now, we as Christians start to feel a little awkward about what Habakkuk is actually saying. Violence is rampant, but you, God, have failed. Habakkuk is so overwhelmed with the violence that he lashes out at God. The prophet has the audacity to say that which we might only admit in our deepest of hearts sometimes. With violence of the world raging around us, it feels like God has failed. And Habakkuk not only says this audacious thought, he says it out loud to God. The most remarkable part of the book of Habakkuk is that God talks back in chapter 2, verse 1. Habakkuk stations himself at the watchpost or at the watchtower, kind of in his defiant way, pointing his finger. I imagine him pointing his finger at God and shaking it, hand on his hip or fists in the air, you know, "Where are you now, God? Answer me." And God says, "Okay, write the vision. Make it plain on tablets. Write it big so that people who are running can read it without having to stop and look at the fine print. Okay? So, you're good. Write it down." God doesn't rebuke Habakkuk. He doesn't chastise the prophet. There's a generosity to this divine response. There's a willingness not only to hear the shouts of this puny human, but to include a memorial that could be read and sent throughout the land. The vision of the world to come that is being offered to God's people in the rest of the book has somehow been wrestled out of God by Habakkuk's angry accusations. And God honors those accusations. The fact that the Holy Scriptures preserve Habakkuk's words testifies to the nature of our God. So I love this about Habakkuk in the Psalms as well, because God not only entertains human laments, but he makes room for human anger, even anger at God. Speaking our anger at God is part of what it means to be righteous. As the book of Habakkuk suggests, it's a kind of brutal honesty that God listens to and respects. From this reading of Habakkuk, in Habakkuk, do you see, do you understand how our gracious God invites us to engage with our anger at God as an integral part of the righteous faith by which we are to live? God's okay with us yelling and shaking our fists in God's face, so to speak. Living by faith in this way demonstrates that we trust God And God welcomes our frustrations when things in this life just don't seem to add up. So that said, the gospel lesson also addresses faith. In the first four chapters of chapter 17, first four verses of chapter 17, Jesus had talked about occasions that bring sin into one's life and a warning not to cause someone else to stumble and fall into sin. He instructed them to forgive those who wronged them if they asked for forgiveness, to forgive them over and over and over and over again, to which the disciples say, give us more faith. I mean, how can we do this? We don't want to forgive this person. They just keep doing the same thing over again, and they come and ask for forgiveness, and they do it again. I can't take them seriously, and you want me to forgive them again and again and again? They ask for more faith, as though Jesus could hand it out like dollar bills. They seem to wonder who in the world could live up to Jesus' expectations without more faith. It seems as though the disciples think that faith is something they can quantify, and they just want or need more of it. Philip Yancey, in his book that he wrote back in 1977, so it's been around a while, but entitled is, Where is God When It Hurts? Wonderful book, and it's a timeless thing. But ask that question for people who are struggling with sickness and illness, and he had an experience with working with Dr. Brand, who worked with lepers and leprosy and all of those kinds of things in India, and then down in, I think it was Mississippi, where there was a refuge for them. But anyways, Philip tells a story about a vibrant young couple who became friends with him and his wife when they lived in Chicago. They were in their 20s. So Philip is 72 years old now. So it was a while ago. But this couple was strong and active, and one day Claudia was diagnosed with Hodgkin's lymphoma and had been given only a 50% chance to live. The doctors did multiple surgeries to remove every visible trace of the cancer, and she was left in the hospital stunned and weak. While both she and her husband, John, were strong Christians, anger at God surged up within them. Why us? Why now? They were angry, and no answers were coming from God. Friends visited her in the hospital, meaning well. One suggested, Claudia, there must be some unconfessed sin in your life, and God's trying to teach you something. These things don't just happen, okay? There's a reason for everything. What do you think God is trying to teach you? Another lady dropped by who had faithfully watched Oral Roberts, Catherine Coleman, and Pat Robertson on the 700 Club over the years, and she told Claudia that sickness is never God's will. It's the devil's work. And God will wait until you can muster up enough faith to believe that you'll be healed. Remember, Claudia, faith can move mountains, and that includes Hodgkin's disease. Truly believe that you'll be healed, and God will answer your prayers. For all of their good intentions, I think the only thing they left Claudia with was a greater sense of guilt and shame. Something was wrong with her because she couldn't muster up enough faith. And she didn't know what she had done that she hadn't confessed. And you go into that vicious cycle of self-doubt and recrimination. Do you remember praying for something to happen? Healing for a friend, for yourself, a loved one? And you prayed every day sincerely for healing to take place, but nothing happened. And you read a text that says, if you have faith the size of a mustard seed, you can say to this mulberry tree, be uprooted and root yourself in the sea, and it would do so. Or you read, if you ask anything in my name, it will be done for you. And yet, no matter how fervent and sincere your prayers, nothing happened as far as you were concerned. So maybe you wondered or still wonder, what good is prayer anyway? When I was 19, my mom had surgery on an enlarged thyroid, which the doctors had been watching for years. When they finally decided to remove it, they discovered that it was malignant and had metastasized into her lungs, and she died 3 months later. In the meantime, we prayed for healing. Many people, friends of theirs, missionary friends from around the country and the world, prayed for healing for my mom, but it was not to be. So did we not have enough faith? How much is enough? And what does Jesus mean when he says things like these? Sayings like this: when our fervent prayers go unanswered can result in our feeling pretty inadequate, like we don't have enough faith. We don't see the results. We question ourselves, our faith, and we question God. I certainly did. Is God listening to us? Those are some of the feelings and questions that I've had to wrestle with through the years. What does it mean to live by faith? And when our prayers aren't answered the way we hope, is it a lack of faith on our part, or is it something else? When we feel like our prayers aren't answered, or that God seems silent, can we express our frustration, our anger to God? It seems to me that many of us feel a lot like the disciples. Overwhelmed by the demands and expectations we feel placed on us to be good Christians, whatever that means to you, and not sure that we are even up to the task, and wondering, what do we get ourselves into here anyway? It's no wonder that some of us feel like being a real disciple is beyond us. David Loos says, faith doesn't have to be heroic. Faith, as Jesus described it here in this text, is simply doing our job, doing our duty, not because of any sense of reward, but simply because of it needs doing. Faith, in other words, is doing what needs to be done right in front of you. And this, Jesus says, the disciples can already do. You know, there's that part in the text, and I think this is what David is getting at, a slave or a servant is to fix the meal for the person for whom they work. They're supposed to do what they're expected to do. You know, and you know, just, that's what you do. What are we to do? People who feel daunted by discipleship, thinking that I'm not spiritual or religious enough, need to hear that faith can be pretty ordinary. Faith isn't an idea, it's a muscle. And the more we use that muscle, the stronger it gets. Jesus told his disciples then, and us now, that we've got all that we need to be faithful. And that being faithful is about recognizing all the God-given opportunities and just show up and do what needs to be done. Doing our work, caring for those in need, protecting the vulnerable, reaching out to the lonely, befriending the friendless, keeping the world going, contributing to the common good. It's all ordinary stuff we do all the time without thinking about it. And taken together and blessed by God, it becomes pretty extraordinary. But faith isn't only a muscle. It is also an adventure. Faith is putting one foot in front of the other and walking toward a future that we cannot see, but trusting that God will guide us along the way. Faith is heading out the door each day looking for opportunities to be God's partner and co-worker in the world. Faith is imagining that the various challenges put in front of us, whether solving a problem at work or forgiving someone who wronged us, are exactly the opportunities that invite us to grow as disciples and witness to God's presence and goodness in the world. At the end of our worship services, at least when I'm here, and I don't know if you do this other Sundays, but anyways, when I'm here, this is what we do. We sing the prayer of good courage. You know, if you don't remember the words, you know, I hope that you will memorize them at some point. But, oh God, you have called us. to ventures where we cannot see the end, by paths never yet taken, through perils unknown. Give us good courage, not knowing where we go, to know that your hand is leading us wherever we must go. Faith is boldly stepping out onto paths never yet taken. We don't know where they will lead us, but trusting that God will be with us every step of the way. So let us live. Amen.